I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 15th of September. All things political this hour, which you hear every Monday at 1 o'clock. And we're delighted to have Dan Frumkin with us. Dan Frumkin is a senior writer for The Intercept. It's the new online publication that was started this year. Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill, who's been on the show frequently, are two of the editors. President Obama's plan to defeat the Islamic State. Is he betraying the Constitution? Who are the moderate forces in Syria who would help fight ISIS? Does Congress not want to vote on authorization for conflict before the November elections? Who really has a deep understanding of this region? Why did the president invoke Yemen and Somalia? Was it actually a sign of minimalism? Wisconsin's voter ID law can go into effect immediately. Is voter fraud that much of a problem? Hillary Clinton will probably run for president, and we are now 7 weeks until the midterm elections. How are things looking? Those are a few of the things we'll be talking about. It's plenty on the agenda for this Monday, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as well. For you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We're also on Facebook, where we love to read your thoughts and messages, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Dan Frumkin is our guest this hour from The Intercept. He's a reporter, a columnist, and editor who focuses on U.S. politics and media. He wrote the White House Watch column at the Washington Post for a number of years. He has a 30-year career in journalism, served as the senior Washington correspondent and bureau chief for the Huffington Post, was editor of WashingtonPost.com, deputy editor of NeimanWatchdog.org. Recent columns of his are headlined, "More Imperial Hubris Than Bush. Was Obama actually asking everyone to chill?" News organizations finally realize Obama's war plan is a hot mess, and the almost non-existent Congressional Restraint Caucus. Dan, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Before we talk about all that there is to talk about, how is the new venture going? It's really a good site.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it's been, you know, it's been slow to get up and running, and we still have a long way to go, but we're really excited about what we're doing. It's called The Intercept. It is part of with a company called First Look Media that is funded by the eBay founder, Pierre Omidyar. And the goal of this site and of all the other sites that are coming is really to be fundamentally adversarial and accountability-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
We feel like a lot of the mainstream media has gotten too cozy with the sources, with its sources, with the newsmakers, and that sort of there's an elite political class that includes the media rather than having the media outside lobbing, you know, lobbing brickbats at them.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all about basically really presenting an adversarial view and challenging authority, both governmental and corporate.
Well, Jeremy is a neighbor of ours and has been on the show since he was very, very young and is such a fearless young man. So please give him our best. And
yes, well, he is fearless. And that
yes.
I'm much more fearful than he is, but but most of us are.
Yeah.
And he is wonderful to work with. And Glenn Greenwald is wonderful to work with. And Laura Poitras, who is the third co-founder, is spectacular. It's an amazing group of people.
Yeah, it is an amazing group of people. All right, well, let's talk about this war. You wrote an interesting column, and let's just give the headline here. Was Obama actually asking everyone to chill? Your Thursday column that you wrote. Was he just asking people to chill? Why did he bring up Yemen and Somalia?
Yeah, it's funny. I find myself in the incredibly unique position for me of agreeing with Charles Krauthammer, who wrote a piece, I think, just the other day, saying that it seems like Obama is being drawn into this reluctantly. And when I, you know, when I looked carefully at the speech, it struck me that he was, in fact, not using the more hyperbolic constructions of a lot of the people who were supporting the war, supporting a great military action. And exactly in the use of Somalia and Yemen, he seemed to be indicating something very far from, you know, shock and awe, much more of a protracted, slow march towards something. And so I got the impression that he felt he had to jump onto this war bandwagon. I think that was because of the combination of the politics, of the media spin, and of the, you know, the fact that you can't watch or even hear about these beheading videos without getting pretty emotional about this issue. But that, on the other hand, he was still being the Obama whose foreign policy is don't do stupid stuff, and is still trying to avoid going, you know, launching into something huge.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the people who really understand this region, it's always amazing to me that there don't seem to be that many people who are used by the press who have a really deep understanding of who the moderate forces are in Syria, what the internal politics are in many of these countries. You quote in one of your pieces, and we thought we've got to get him on the air as well, somebody who has a deep understanding of the region. He's a Boston University political science professor, former Army colonel who lost his son in the Iraq War in 2007. And his comments were really spot on, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even want to paraphrase what he wrote because it was so moving to me. But yeah, if you go to The Intercept and click on Frumkin, and then you go down to the item I wrote about him, which was which one was that? Was it News Organizations Finally Realize Obama's War Plan is a Hot Mess? I think that might have been.
I think that was it.
It's exactly right. And one of the things that actually I'm really intent on doing in the column/blog that I'm writing here is quoting people who actually seem to understand what they're talking about and who have a track record of getting things right. So often you see in the media people being quoted about something like this, being the neocons who suggest we would have a cakewalk in Iraq. And instead there are a lot of people who just don't seem to get the media coverage. Maybe they're not as self-aggrandizing, who really do understand what's going on. And Bacevich is one. I wrote a piece earlier, a couple days earlier, about how the media was basically cheerleading and baying for blood rather than challenging arguments for war. And I had the chance to quote three more people there who really understand the situation. And exactly, everybody who really understands the Middle East that I know of is horrified at the complexity of the situation, at this you know, threading of a needle that would have to be accomplished to somehow arm exactly the right people to fight exactly the wrong people. The Middle East just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. So what about the constitutionality? That was another of your pieces recently. Why has the president really said that he has the authority to do this? Why wouldn't he go to Congress? And then the second question is, why does Congress not want to vote on this anyhow?
Right. Well, that's the bigger question, because the reality is that every president always wants to exercise their power and not leave the presidency diminished for the next president and so on. And they're surrounded by advisors who are, you know, saying that they have great power and shouldn't give it up to Congress. So to some extent, despite, you know, the fact that Obama spoke eloquently about the need to restrain the executive branch back when he was a senator, I'm not entirely surprised that he's doing this. And especially given his record in such issues as surveillance and drone warfare and targeted killings, the guy has not been dovish on executive power. The question then is, why isn't Congress stepping up and insisting that it play its constitutional role? And the answer is that Congress can't do anything right now, and Congress also doesn't. You know, it's all about politics and fear with Congress these days, and there's no political upside to taking Obama on this one, and there's no and you can only be accused of not being strong enough. So but despite what I said, though, I mean, there are some people who are still legitimately surprised that Obama took this step, because this seems like even more than any of the things he's done before as far as grabbing executive power. He is citing, as his legitimate, you know, his people are saying that the reason he has the authority to do this is the 2001 authorization for the use of military force, which was signed by Congress, and which basically gave the president a lot of latitude to take on Al Qaeda. And so his advisors are saying that because ISIS is essentially Al Qaeda, they're allowed to do this. And objectively, that it's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Al Qaeda and ISIS are two very distinct organizations. They're actually, at some degrees, competitive rather than collaborative. And so a lot of legal scholars who have spent their lives sort of studying these issues are saying that is just not going to fly. Except that who's going to argue it? And it's not like anybody's going to take the case to the Supreme Court right now.
It was so peculiar to me that the president took a lot of criticism a couple of weeks before he gave this address, saying, well, we don't, maybe it wasn't even a couple of weeks, we don't really have a strategy yet. And all of a sudden we get this major announcement. Who was on him during that period of time saying, you better get a strategy together, lickety-split?
Well, you're assuming there is a strategy now. I'm not really sure what he described counts as a strategy. It's a bunch of things he says that they'll do which aren't doable. I think precisely what happened was there was this incredible emotional rush to war in Washington, which he, I think, recognized he couldn't fight if he'd wanted to. Mm-hmm. One of the things I was thinking about writing today was looking at this one element, which is a key element, of course, was the reaction to these awful
yes.
videos
yes.
showing the beheading of two journalists by ISIS. You can't even hear about that, but you certainly can't watch that without just being your blood boiling,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
But you have to step back and look at, well, why are they doing this? And you can't help but conclude that one of the reasons they're doing this and advertising it so blatantly is because they want a reaction. They want the United States to attack them and therefore be the champions of Islam. And so, you have to look at what it is that your enemies want you to do and mm-hmm. sometimes not do it.
Mm-hmm.
I could make the same argument about 9/11. I think it only in Osama bin Laden's wildest dreams could the U.S. have become sort of the totalitarian torturing nation in response to being victimized like they were.
So we're depending on these Iraqi forces who threw down their arms when they were challenged by ISIS and these Syrian moderate forces. I have yet to talk to anybody who can tell me with any complexity who in the world these Syrian moderate forces are. Does anybody know that? I mean, is this a plan that could possibly work? Who's going to be fighting for us?
Well, yeah, I mean, the moment I heard that his strategy was, training soldiers, I just shook my head, because this has been a completely failed policy for a decade now. I mean, this is the one thing by now we should know we can't do. We've spent literally billions of dollars training Afghan and Iraqi soldiers. And the first serious test in Iraq, and they turn tail. It's not a viable strategy. And then you have the added complication, exactly like you said, of trying to figure out who in Syria are the good guys and who are the bad guys and who aren't, and the good guys contains the bad guys and bad guys contains the good guys in a matter of weeks. And there are some, factions that are identified as, likely to be able to be, likely to be pro-American and anti-ISIS. But in some cases, they're actually, called terrorist organizations by our allies in Saudi Arabia or, or in Iraq. It's hideously complicated. And, in one of these senior administration official briefings, they sort of tossed up, we'll do a lot of vetting. I don't know how you can do vetting.
Yeah. Dan Frumkin is our guest, and he is from The Intercept, which is a relatively new site started by Glenn Greenwald, and it will feature the reporting from Edward Snowden, of course. But it's very well done. The investigative journalists who are part of this are pull no punches, and they write very well, and it's a site worth looking at. Dan is a reporter, a columnist, and editor. He focuses on U.S. politics and media. Worked for the Washington Post for a number of years, Huffington Post as well. We're welcoming phone calls. Obviously, a big chunk of this hour will be devoted to what the president's plan is for getting rid of ISIS, what questions we as Americans should ask about that plan, the pressure to have some kind of plan, whether or not there should be congressional authorization for this plan, And we will talk about that. Also, we have other issues to look at, which we will during this hour. The midterms are now just 7 weeks away, not very far at all. And we have some voter ID cases, one in North Carolina, and voter ID in Wisconsin will carry on now, even though there is some problem with absentee ballots that have already been mailed out without instructions about voter ID. From what I've been able to glean from most people who have been on this show of moderate Republican persuasion or Democratic persuasion, voter fraud has not been a huge problem in this country. So is this politically motivated? And will it just become the law of the land in a lot of states? What do you make of that? Will it be problematic for Wisconsin voters? Or is it something that should be in place to protect the sanctity of the vote? Hillary Clinton probably running for office. What are the chances of the Senate going Republican? Those are just a few of the other issues that we will get to. But let's start with this big story, which is how we go about defeating ISIS. Here's the phone number. Lines are open for you right now. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcoming phone calls this hour, All Things Political, Dan Frumkin is our guest. What do you make of the president's speech last week and what plans it is we have to defeat ISIS? The administration did say yesterday that several Arab nations had offered to join in airstrikes against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. What about the fighting forces? Do you have questions answered? Do you think this is a good venture for us? We welcome your phone calls and on anything else political as well. All right. Our guest is Dan Frumkin, senior writer for The Intercept, the new online publication launched this year by Glenn Greenwald. And we start our calls with Anita in Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, Anita.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for this interesting program. I think what I would just want to state here is the elephant in the room. And that is that things are never really going the way that the public understands them to go. You know, it's sort of like Penn and Teller. Look over here. Look over here. Here's all the conflict. But what actually the deals are being done in other rooms. And I think that Obama is being very, very smart this time because this is a hot potato. Nobody wants this at election time to be having to finger pointed at them, oh, this was a Republican war, that the Republicans got us into the war. Oh, Obama got us into the war. Nobody wants to be that guy at election time when they're up on the dais and pointing the fingers. And so at this time, Obama's getting his strategy together, but you better believe that he wants congressional backing. And that is the name of this hesitation right now, and I think he's being wise.
Dan, what do you say?
I think there's a lot to what you said, and certainly Congress has no interest in getting into this before the election. It's a no-win situation for them. The question for Obama, I think he definitely wants congressional backing, but I don't think he is willing to admit that he needs their authorization. But I think he's going to go to them and ask them, for instance, for this $50 billion to train Syrian moderates, all that in air quotes. and then the other question is whether he's, you know, going to be using this sort of time that he's gotten for himself, and you're exactly right, because to build up the war effort, or to basically sort of hope that people's attention span will be short and that something else will come up.
Obviously, you have to. You think about this a lot, Dan. But obviously, with all the attention given to the beheadings of American journalists and all of the blood that was shed in the Iraq War and certainly the Afghanistan War, we're talking years and years and years and years. Do you think that part of the problem is we've just got to take care of this issue because we've already invested so much time? So we got to come up with something because it's our responsibility to right these horrendous wrongs?
You know, that assumes that we can. If we could fix it, I think you could make a very powerful argument that we should try to mess things up so badly. I don't think we can fix it. So continuing to try to fix it the way that has been proven over and over again to actually make things worse isn't doing anybody any favors. Mm.
Thanks, Anita, for your call. Jill in Green Bay, hi. Jill, hi.
Hi, this is Jill. I'm trying to say the same thing as the gentleman ahead of me saying, please, we have spent so much money trying to raise our kids, and we as parents had to take out life insurance policies and co-sign their student loans of hundreds of thousands of dollars. I don't want my son killed or their daughters. Why don't we just take over the best prime land of these countries, put them in protective settlements, and guard them, and let all of the other tribes fend for themselves. But we'll take over the best of that land and protect the people who want to be law-abiding and compassionate and human beings to the rest of the world. Okay? Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. You know, it does bring to mind constantly what other countries in the region, what they're doing to respond to all of this. You would think if you were living in Saudi Arabia or any of these neighboring countries, you'd be darn jittery about all of this, wouldn't you? That you would have to have perhaps the most important strategy to confront these groups.
Well, but you're forgetting that they contributed to this situation as well in a lot of ways. I mean, the Saudis have financially backed the anti-Syrian government forces, some of whom have become ISIS. So everybody's hip deep into this. I think that I don't think there's a lucid argument for how the Arab countries can solve this themselves. But since I think the last 10 years have shown that the U.S. can't solve it by itself, perhaps we should toss the ball over to them.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. We'll go back to this in a moment, but I wanted to move to midterm elections, which are just a mere 7 weeks away. Where do things stand at the moment? If you look at the odds, are they still great that the Republicans will take the Senate, Dan?
I think so. I'm not a big handicapper, so... it's not my real area. I did want to talk about your particular problem in Wisconsin.
Okay.
I've actually done a lot of reporting on the voter ID movement, and I was just absolutely gobsmacked by this decision on Friday, because for so many reasons. I mean, one of which is it's going to throw your election operations into a complete...
I would think
busy.
So. Mm-hmm.
Some of my very favorite source people I ever talked to on the job when I was a local newspaper reporter were elections officials. I love elections officials. they're just good people.
I know, they are, aren't they? I know.
Yeah. And I feel so bad for them because all of a sudden they're in complete chaos. And especially with some of the ballots already having gone out, it is absolutely ludicrous to change the rules 7 weeks before an election. As far as I know, it's never been done. It is a really, really poor activist decision by these judges. And then secondly, I'm just always amazed that judges buy this argument at all because there is no evidence that voter fraud is a problem of any significance. There is considerable, an enormous amount of evidence that some people have a hard time getting to the polls.
Right.
And so, I just find this a classic sort of patriotic thing. An American view in this should be we're trying to get everybody who can to vote, and that should be the number one priority. And, in the absence of some evidence that there's any kind of significant fraud, it's a no-brainer for me.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think the response will be? Will there be huge efforts to make sure those who are frail, those who don't have cars and don't have driver's license, there will be a registration, there will be an effort to get them to the DMV and wait in line to get voter ID?
Well, sure. I mean, the voting rights groups often will definitely be doing that, but it's interesting. It's a hard problem to solve. The people who are in most need of getting help are hard to find and hard to help. And so it sounds like it's easy, but it's not. I wouldn't be surprised if the full circuit court actually enjoins the three judge panels.
Mm-hmm.
just out of practicality. I don't know what these three judges were thinking, but this is a very dramatic act. I mean, it was interesting to see who these three judges were, especially one of them, which was this Judge Diane Sykes, who was on the Supreme Court before, and who is just one of the most openly partisan federal judges out there. She and Clarence Thomas co-headlined, very controversially, a fundraiser for the Federalist Society a while back, which is a very, you know, very adamantly right-wing partisan legal organization. And so, you know, I don't know. I'm not sure what the makeup of the entire Seventh Circuit is, but one would imagine that some wiser heads would prevail there and you know, have mercy on the elections officials of your state.
Well, they obviously have a significant problem with all those absentee ballots that have already gone out, and there's no voter ID stipulation. So what do you do with all of those votes?
Well, there'll inevitably be massive amounts of lawsuits no matter what happens.
Right,
I mean,
right.
You know, so if they try to do this. So that's why it has to get undone soon. I mean, I don't know. I'm hoping. You never know.
Yeah, you never know. All right, let's go to Maryland in Cleveland, Wisconsin. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political you're listening to on the Ideas Network. And Dan Frumkin is our guest, senior writer for The Intercept. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Kathleen. I hate to get off of the ID problem because I totally agree with your guest, but I had a question for him about Syria. I had read on the internet that our wonderful free Syrian army has been beheading ISIS prisoners. And I do not know that the internet is necessarily always God's truth. And so I'm wondering if you know anything about it.
I don't, and you know, it depends where on the internet you saw it. whether it's an apocryphal story or true, it is a reminder that that these forces are sometimes somewhat interchangeable.
Do you want to make a comment on voter ID, Marilyn, beyond agreeing with Dan?
I can say that I agree with Dan. There has been almost no fraud. The only fraud that's being committed is on the part of the Republicans. So that's my comment.
All right. Thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
An email that has come in, Dan Gary from Iron River, says the requirement of a photo voter ID should be the law of the land nowadays. The system Wisconsin is now putting in place is simple and fair and is not an outward, untoward burden on anyone.
Except for that last part, he's basically right. I mean, it's common sense, right? You need your photo ID to cash a check or whatever. Why shouldn't you use it for voting? But the answer is that for a small section of the population, it's not so easy. For elderly people whose driver's licenses have expired, for people who are institutionalized, for people who are just very poor and live in areas of the country where they have no need for ID. These people exist, and Gary would disenfranchise them out of a principle that is doing, you know, which is a nice principle in theory, but not even that significant. There's no proof that there is any significant amount of in-person voter fraud. In fact, the most common form of voter fraud is through absentee ballots, which there's no ID for. So, people who believe that you ought to demand ID at the polls are, in my mind, either delusional because they think there's a problem that doesn't exist, or they're insincere. The real reason they want to support this is to disenfranchise people who are the least attached to society and are therefore the most likely to vote Democratic or not Republican, at least.
Greg in Sheboygan, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Dan, I'm interested in your thoughts about whether what we're experiencing in the Middle East right now is simply the natural consequence of what the West did following World War I to set up these artificial boundaries and create these so-called nation states out of these numerous tribes. And I'm wondering what your view would be in terms of how the West, and if the West, can possibly do it right at this point and extricate itself in some fashion that is... It is helpful, if not continually, to make a mess.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it's interesting that certainly, clearly, sort of the imperial sort of divvying up the Middle East was a flawed move, and over the years led to a lot of totalitarian states. Interestingly enough, things didn't really go all pear-shaped until we invaded Iraq, though. And, you know, Iraq was a classic nation-state put together, which was actually, you know, trying to combine Kurds and Sunnis and Shiites. And under Saddam, there was some stability. Last thing in the world I'm saying is we needed to keep Saddam in power. But going in the way we did, we just let loose the dogs of war all over the place. And so I would say that what's happening now is a natural consequence of the decision in 2003. Well, it wasn't a decision. The action in 2003 of invading Iraq for no legitimate purpose and for under false pretenses and setting up a free-for-all in the most, you know, difficult region of the world. And as far as what we can do about it, I don't know. I don't think we can. I don't think we can fix it. I don't think we can, you know, corral everybody into fenced enclaves and tell them to behave. That's not the way human beings should be treated, and it's not the way things work, especially in the Middle East.
Thanks, Greg, for your call. Michael emails, I don't believe the public is behind this war. Although I might add that the public seems to be supportive of this, especially if you ask them to pay for it. No new taxes. And 6 months from now, our politicians will be telling us we are broke and we have to cut Social Security. We need a congressional vote, and this includes paying for it this time.
Yeah. I mean, another astonishing precedent set by George Bush was to put the war on his tab. You know, it was basically just added to the national debt, and so that, you know, the Chinese paid for it. And we would be in that situation again if we were in a major war effort. So I think the cost in blood and treasure is absolutely something that ought to be discussed. I think I don't think the public is deeply for this in the sense that I think a lot of the reaction in the polls was this revulsion, this... Mm-hmm. You know, this sort of a very provocative act. I think over time you'll see that the support will dissipate or will prove to have been not very deep in the first place.
So, what forces would have rallied against the president if he had just sort of continued on that first announcement? Well, we really don't have a strategy. And instead, he had come before the microphone and said just what you said, that unfortunately, there is nothing that we can do, that this is beyond our poor power to do much of anything. And so we just have to let it play out. How would people have responded?
Not well. I mean, the thing is, especially in Washington, where and in the circles where sort of the narrative is set, people want leadership, strength, authority, and so the little play, the way this was playing out, was that Obama was being weak and indecisive,
right.
And the media was really jumping onto that story. You know, the traditional, theoretically liberal media was all over this. And when's he going to act? What's he going to do? When's he going to stand up and finally do something about this? And there was literally, I couldn't find anything in the mainstream media suggesting that there was maybe a reason to not. And not by coincidence, the day after Obama gives his speech, finally the press starts writing about what a mistake he's making.
Right. Right.
I mean, the New York Times had two really great stories the next day, you know, pointing out, or the day after, pointing out just,
right.
You know, how impossible this plan would be, how impossible it is to find, you know, Syrian moderates who are reliable, and pointing out that the intelligence agencies, oh, by the way, have agreed that there's no actual threat to the United States.
Yeah. What are you to do?
Yeah.
Susan in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. With regard to voter ID, to really honor the right to vote, and not disenfranchise anyone, wouldn't we want to be sure that everyone had an ID before the voter ID would go into effect?
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to do it, except, again, you have to, you know, is it possible? I mean, it's going to be very hard to draw our two themes together here, but in both cases, you're saying, well, let's just solve the problem. What if the problem is insoluble? Then you figure out other ways to at least deal with it. And the way that we as a country have decided to deal with the fact that not everybody has ID is to not demand it when people vote.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never been a problem. You know, and what you've seen in the states that have, in fact, you know, demanded picture voter ID is little ladies being turned away because their driver's licenses were expired because they haven't driven in 10 years. You know, it was people who everybody at the precinct knew personally,
right,
but didn't have the right piece of paper.
Yeah.
So yeah, it would be nice if everybody could have ID. Although, you know, it's interesting. Where are the libertarians saying that, you know, we don't want to turn this into everybody has to have an ID card? But anyway.
Has this issue been around for a while? Do you know, Dan, requests for voter ID photo years ago, or is it recent?
I think it's pretty recent.
Is it?
I mean, it part of it also has to do with just, you know, the fact that country's gotten so much bigger over time. It used to be your election official knew you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was never even a possibility, never a concern. But, of course, there's a long tradition, however, of people coming up with ways to block other people from voting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the Voting Rights Act was all about. And the Voting Rights Act, of course, is now sort of been hobbled by the Supreme Court and is not going anywhere in Congress.
More phone calls momentarily. You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network, and our guest is Dan Frumkin. Dan is senior writer at The Intercept, which is a relatively new website started by Glenn Greenwald. Edward Snowden has a piece today on if you live in Australia, you're being watched. We will talk about that. Dan has written a great deal about, he's been analyzing what people have said about what our response is in the Middle East. He's also, as you heard him say, done a lot of work on voter ID. So those are the big stories. But feel free to move us into other areas if you would like to do that. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Just a look ahead. The Roosevelt, as you know, is on public broadcasting. I saw last night's 2 hours, and it's very well done. What a cast of characters, huh? Eleanor and Teddy and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The person, Jeffrey Ward, has been a part of that, and Jeffrey has done the book that accompanies this massive effort. Jeffrey will be with us to talk about the Roosevelts Wednesday at 2 o'clock. So if you're watching and you would like to participate in an on-air conversation about the documentary, we'd like to hear from you Wednesday at 2. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Thomas in Madison. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you, Thomas?
I'm good.
Good.
I was hoping to make a comment or maybe discuss with you and your guests this voter ID law. And I think take kind of a middle ground analysis of this. I mean, I think your guest is right in that this is clearly and all over the country, really, an attempt by the Republican Party to suppress the vote, and I use that word sort of loosely. So that's kind of undeniable, I think, and it's sort of disingenuous for Republicans to deny that. On the other hand, I would say that it's a fairly reasonable thing to have in place. I mean, it's been upheld in other states for a long time now. I think it did go up in the federal courts, and maybe a state like Indiana or maybe even Ohio some years ago. So it's not like we're out of step with what other courts all over the country have deemed to be relevant and, you know, appropriate. So I'm also not sure there isn't any proof that there have been fraud issues in the past. Wasn't there something in Milwaukee recently that was ironically a Republican actually getting into trouble for voting multiple times in person?
Yeah, it was in Sherwood.
So, I'm sorry?
It was in Sherwood.
Yes, in that area. So, I don't know that it seems perfectly reasonable. And on the other hand, I also think, you know, in the little old lady scenario, if she, you know, is turned away at the polls, but is somehow able to make it to the voting polling place, then presumably she's somehow able to make it to the DMV or wherever to update her license. Now, I'm not trying to, you know, suggest that, you know, we shouldn't be concerned about people who have limitations like the elderly or others in getting around. But you know what I mean? I mean, there is sort of a sense of reasonableness here. So those are my thoughts.
All right. Thank you very much, Thomas. Dan?
Yeah, well, I mean, there is the common sense argument, which is, you know, why not, right? Why, but the reality is that sometimes, you know, a minority of folks live lives that are not like, you know, those of yours or mine or the caller, and they live lives without ID, or they've lost their ID, or they're homeless, or they're, you know, there's any number of reasons why people who are, you know, generally sort of on the down and out side, or live lives that are just not part of the, you know, sort of fast moving culture, don't have ID, and so why would you disenfranchise them? Why would you take a system and turn it into one that turn these people away at the polls? Why would you turn anyone away at the polls if they're entitled to the vote and isn't everybody? So there has to be a really, really persuasive reason for you to do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that something like, you know, 15 cases of voter fraud out of, you know, some billion votes a year are uncovered, just doesn't do it.
And I think you use the phrase that's really important in this. You are entitled to vote. You are entitled to vote.
It's your right. You don't have a right to drive a car. You don't have a right to cash a check. You have a right to vote.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't be. That should not be taken away except with due process.
Claire in Baraboo. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. What a great show today. I went to the Fighting Bob Fest this last weekend. It was held in Baraboo. It was the 13th year. There was an excellent turnout, and it was so exciting, Kathleen. Senator Bernie Sanders came to speak, mm-hmm. among other great speakers. he said something, well, he said lots of things that were really outstanding, but he made a really good point that I wanted to share with the listeners and your guests. An expert analyze the United States, what it would take to get our infrastructure back on track at about $3 trillion. That would be our roads, our bridges, our railroads, which all need to be updated. And it would, of course, create thousands, possibly millions of great jobs for people that we desperately need. That happens to be the same amount, Kathleen, that we spent on the war in Iraq, $3 trillion. What do we have to show for that?
I'm not going to answer that question.
That's a valid question. I don't know.
I should point out that the $3 trillion figure also includes projected spending going forward on things like taking care of wounded veterans. I mean, it's the costs are not over.
So what do you do? The broader question, and thank you, Claire, very much for the call, is what do you do when you're confronted by really horrible groups and evil in the world? I mean, a lot of people would like to believe that it is the job of the United States to make the world a better place, and that these kinds of groups can't exist in the world, or they will destroy human beings. We can't have this kind of, some would call, barbarism exist, and we have the power, maybe not the strategy yet, but we have the power militarily and the minds and the money to do something about it.
Well, we have the military power to do something about it, and yeah, I mean, I you can't look at those videos and not want death with every, you know, cell in your body for justice to be brought against these people. But if what they want you to do is attack them, and they have a reason to feel that way, you've got to go about it some other way. I mean, and I am not happy with the dearth of other options. I feel like the folks who are against military action should be presenting, you know, a much more coherent plan for how we could go about solving this problem other than militarily. I think the answer is also, however, very politically unpalatable. It would probably the easiest way would be to ally with Iran and work with them to solve this problem. But that's not very palatable. Even less palatable is working with Assad.
Right.
Gassed his own people, which is the last horrible indignity against human beings that we experience in that region. So perhaps it's a longer term position where you you try to just sort of help the neighbors figure out ways to do good. But there, as I said, I have no easy answer to that. I can just say that time and time again, when we've attacked people in the Middle East, it has not served us well.
David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi.
Oh, just listening to all these things. As far as it would help to have a strong UN. It was getting stronger, but then when Bush sort of ignored and just that weakened it a lot. My two things, voter ID, I wouldn't care if Mexicans came up here who are working in our fields voting. My brother-in-law lives in Saudi Arabia. There's only a few Saudis that are, you know, Saudi citizens. A whole bunch of people aren't citizens, and they're second class. So they don't have the rights that Saudis do. And do you want to live in a country where essentially going back to slavery? Well, so there's a group of people without rights, and the rest of us have, you know, I don't like that.
Yeah, well, I think you need to be an American citizen to vote. I mean, that makes sense to me. How about you, Dan?
Yeah, well, I mean, you need to be a citizen, and certainly the people who are the most a lot of the states that are the most adamant about voter ID have been the border states because they're worried about the illegal immigrants or the immigrants' mm-hmm. documentation voting, and of course that's natural. That they would fear that. They fear everything that has to do with the non-documented. But no, I think that it's like I said, it's a right that American citizens have. It is not a right that American non-citizens have, and that needs to be enforced, and traditionally it has been.
Joanne in Reedsburg, hi.
Hi. I wonder if your guest could speak to the role of the United States military-industrial complex in relation to our going to war again in Iraq against ISIS. Almost every congressional district in the United States has a military contractor that our representatives are accountable to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the way that the military industrial complex expresses itself is not through direct action; it's through just sort of making the system less, slightly more hostile to peaceniks and slightly more friendly to people who want to use the military. There's no political downside to acting tough these days. Whereas if you act weak, all of a sudden, you know, a lot of money shows up to oppose you. I would add to that, it's actually the military-industrial intelligence complex. Because what we're seeing through the leaks from whistleblowing leaks from Edward Snowden, and is the incredible power and the incredible size of the surveillance state and the both governmental and contractor intelligence organizations that are very influential, I think, in policy circles in the U.S. I mean, if you look at some of the things that we are hard to understand why Obama did them, given what he used to say. A lot of them have to do with him not wanting to tick off the intelligence establishment.
Thank you so much for the call. Dan, thank you. You fielded lots of calls, and I appreciate your being with us. I hope you'll join us again.
So happens you touched on the two topics I care about a lot, know about a lot.
Right.
So we'll try to do that again.
Good. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Dan
Frumkin, our guest. Dan is a reporter, a columnist, and editor. He's on this relatively new website, and it's The Intercept. You can find it. It's good. It's a good site. It's covering all that's going on in the world these days. And Dan has spent a lot of time looking at our policy in the Mideast. And it turns out voter fraud was on his list of issues he's been covering as well. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the program. And thanks to Lisa Nalbandian and Scott Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with another hour.